Good morning. Good morning. It's an incredible morning. It's morning in America, as Ronald Reagan used to say.
It is.
Oh, my goodness. What a morning. Hey, listen, this is KBOO, 90.7 on the FM dial. And this is Talk Radio with me, Joe Uris, and Abe Proctor.
Yeah, I don't know if you can hear me.
You know, it's KBOO.
It's KBOO.
It's KBOO. 90.7 on the FM, 231-8187. It's Talk Radio. We got so much.
Yeah, we do. Oh, there I am.
Hey, he's here. Okay. We got so much to talk about. It's very exciting and sad to some extent because my good friend Stu Albert is gone. I'm going to talk about Haiti and the I got a lot of stuff, man. I got the National. You remember I last week I talked about the National Endowment for Democracy.
Yeah.
Okay, I got more on them, and I got the International Republican Institute. A big article in the New York Times yesterday. Rather Sunday, talking about the role of the International Republican Institute, which is like this National Endowment. These are these private but funded by the government sometimes kind of agencies that kind of like the CIA on a private mission. The International Republican Institute.
Like the CIA on a private mission?
Yeah. Yeah, weird. Kind of quasi-private, public kind of never quite
paramilitary,
propaganda kind of things
quasi.
That actually in this case completely screwed over Haiti, totally miserable already, even more miserable after the International Republican Institute, which has responded and said, "Oh, it's not so," but not very effectively. Big article in the New York Times on that one. Okay, that's foreign policy gone awry thanks to the Republican Party. John McCain, one of the big founders of the IRA. Okay,
right.
We're going to talk about that. I want to just mention the sad passing of Stu Albert. I understand you're going to do all Abramoff all the time.
Well, we were going to do all Abramoff all the time, but Melanie Sloan has informed us she's not going to be with us today.
So we're not going to do all Abramoff.
I would mention him. I wanted to mention the fact that American Corporation just posted the largest profit in the history of the universe.
See, capitalism works.
It does.
Oh, boy, does it work.
Is it working?
Is it working? Well, let me guess. Which corporation is that? Let me guess. Is it ExxonMobil?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
My God!
Hey!
He knows all and sees
how
all.
To figure that one out. Gee, and is that about the price of oil?
It is, among other things. We'll talk about that.
Okay, you're going to talk about that, and then we're going to talk about the big demos today all over the country.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about the inevitable end of legal abortion.
Yes, and the state of disunion.
That's right.
You know, legal abortion has been...
The state of disunion or dat union?
Disunion.
Disunion, okay.
Yeah. We're going to also talk about how, if we're going to talk about the abortion issue, how in essence, in many states, women can't get an abortion.
No, they can't.
Already. I mean, it's without any legal, you know.
A number of states have laws already written, waiting to be voted upon by their legislature.
Right, and in many states, in fact, it's the doctor. It's become so complex and difficult that women have to travel, which means, of course, as it always was, middle and upper class women can have their abortions, but poor women can't, which makes perfect sense.
Of course.
Anyway, and of course, on top of all that, the big question that constantly plays on my brain, where are the Democrats?
Yeah, we'll talk about that,
too. We have to talk about that. All this and more on KBOO.
Yeah.
You want to...
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm on a roll here.
You're on a roll. Do it to it.
I just want to talk about this Haiti thing very briefly.
Okay.
I'm not going to spend a long time on this, but, you know, it's just... Everyone should know. The government of Haiti, the Aristide government, which was a reform-minded, you know, Aristide, former priest, reform-minded government, a democratically elected government, blown out of the water by the interference of the International Republican Institutes. Institute, founded in 1983, nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to advancing democracy, freedom, self-government, and the rule of law worldwide. IRI programs are nonpartisan, adhere to the fundamental American principles of individual freedom, equal opportunity, and the entrepreneurial spirit that fosters economic development. Sounds swell.
Oh, yeah.
Founded by President Ronald Reagan after his 1982 speech before the British Parliament in Westminster, where he proposed a broad objective of helping countries build the infrastructure of democracy. The Westminster speech led to the establishment of the National Endowment for Democracy by Congress in 1983. The NED is a mechanism that channels congressional funds to the four institutes, the International Republic Institute, the International Democratic Institute for International Affairs, the Center for International Private Enterprise, and the American Center for International Labor Solidarity. These organizations are uniquely qualified to provide technical assistance to aspiring Democrats, that's small d, worldwide. In its infancy, IRI focused on planting the seeds of democratic institutions and processes in Latin America. Since the end of the Cold War, IRI has broadened its reach to support democracy around the globe. IRA has conducted programs in more than 100 countries and is currently active in more than 60 countries. Chaired by U.S. Senator John McCain, includes former Secretary of State Engelberger, former Permanent Representative of the United Nations Jean Kirkpatrick. See, it's broadly bipartisan. No, so far Republican. Brent Snowcroft, House of Representatives and Senate. Lauren Kramer, Craner assumed leadership, and Craner and his buddies essentially torpedoed by supporting the old-time fascist, let's say it, leadership of Haiti against the liberal administration of Aristide. You know, Aristide was rescued by the U.S. during the firefights there in Haiti.
Right.
And then, to his amazement, he was taken away.
Yeah, he was bundled off in the middle of the night, thrown in an airplane, and taken to Africa.
Yeah, well, you know, he is black.
Right.
Boy, is that, you know, so what we have is we discover the international, the National Endowments for Democracy interfere in labor issues. They interfere, and I think that's the right word, in all kinds of issues in countries. They are they are autonomous, but they get federal money.
And from that list you read off, they're mostly private citizens, but people who have been in and out of public sector jobs.
Well, it's the revolving door thing.
Right, right.
And essentially they are an arm of the establishment, that is both Republicans and Democrats. Let's be clear about this. And they function. Most people, this is totally under the radar of most people. You'd think the left would be onto this, but they haven't talked much about this. The National Endowment for Democracy essentially is doing the kind of stuff that the CIA used to do and may still do, but it's parallel. It's a parallel function. It's like the Nazis' parallel government.
You know, forming semi-secret back-channel agreements.
Well,
off-the-record agreements?
Well, but also funneling money. For example, a bunch of money was funneled into Palestine prior to this election, you know, for the election. A bunch of money. And that didn't work, of course.
A bunch of money funneled in to elect the right candidate.
To elect the right candidate.
Right.
Exactly. And that's the kind of stuff they do. And they've supported solidarity, you know, prior to the collapse of Poland's communist government.
It becomes kind of darkly funny, doesn't it?
Darkly funny.
I mean, they funnel a bunch of money into the Palestinian elections, and then Hamas goes and wins the election, which would be more funny were they not a violent terrorist organization.
Yeah, that could be a lot more funny. Essentially, it is an arm of American policy, and it is essentially an imperialist operation.
But this is, you know, you might say this is nothing new. Private citizens, or these sort of semi-private citizens, have been engaging in this sort of thing for a long time.
No, it's not something that's new. Well, these organizations and their function and their growth is relatively new, because this all started in the mid-80s. It was a Reagan initiative taken up by both parties. The point is, number one, that the U.S. is engaged interfering in the politics of individual nations throughout the world right now, as we speak. And it's doing it with our public monies as well as private funding. And it's not accountable directly to the American people at all. And it is not the CIA. It is not the Agency for International Development. It is not the U.S. Information Agency. It's something else. And this is a process that has been going on, like I say, since 1983.
So who's getting rich? Somebody's got to be getting rich.
Well, it's not just about money. It's about power.
Oh, aren't they the same thing?
No, they're not always the same thing. A lot of times you get rich after you get the power, or you get money and then you get power. So it's not a simultaneous process necessarily. But don't get hung up on the money question, because in the end, you're right. It is about money.
But I shouldn't get hung up on that.
No, because the scary part of this, I think, is that most people don't even know this is going on. They don't even understand the process. Why did Haiti collapse? Well, this huge, huge, huge article in the New York Times on Sunday outlines the process in which the International Republican Institute played a crucial role in destroying democracy in Haiti and leading to chaos and starvation and misery for the Haitian people. Now it's so dangerous there, I couldn't go there, you couldn't go there. We'd get kidnapped in a week, in a month, in a week, in a minute.
It's that bad. Yeah, that's pretty much the worst economic situation in the Western Hemisphere.
Right.
For a long time now.
Oh, Haiti's always been very, very poor. Haiti's history has always been very sad. You know, it was the first actually the first nation to break away, slave nation, to break away from its slave owners, the French, established a government and was, you know, had a long, hard struggle and has always been, you know, U.S. occupied it in the 19-teens to 1930s. Mm. Always been badly treated, always been misused, always been abused, always been the kind of the whipping boy for American imperialism, actually. Haiti.
A big center of sweatshop textile manufacturing.
Oh, yes. Let us not forget.
And sugar production.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's
cheap labor.
U.S. Marines there now.
Are there?
Yeah. Oh. Well, ever since the coup that ousted Aristide.
Ah, yes. And, of course, like we said, Aristide was hauled away.
Yeah. Well, order must be maintained, you know.
I would think so, especially if we create the disorder in the first place. 231-8187. I want to talk just very briefly about the death of Stu Albert.
All right.
I think it's very
sad. He was on our show not long ago.
He was on our show talking about his book, Who the Hell is Stu Albert? It's a memoir. You know, Stu was one of these really, I think, really interesting people who spend a lot of their time totally committed to social change and progress. And a lot of people of the 60s generation, when they had kids, taught their kids, hey, no drugs, no sex, no rock and roll, and no left politics. Stu Albert, I don't know about the sex or the drugs, but Stu Albert was very insistent on the validity of the politics that he pursued throughout his earlier years. He remained, in other words, a committed leftist with a good perspective, very nice analysis, very funny guy. He was one of the first Yippies, a co-founder of the Yippie International, the Youth International Party. And he was always a very funny guy and also a profound, I think really a profound thinker of the left. He will be missed. And anyway, people who are the giving kind could, in his name, give some money to Planned Parenthood. Because that's what it said in the paper should be done. Got a big obit in today's Oregonian. Even the Oregonian honored him. What can you say?
Oh, I'm sorry we won't be able to have him back.
No,
he struck me as a very big-hearted,
warm-hearted,
thoughtful man.
Very, very thoughtful guy. And in his later years, he in his 60s, he really became kind of a, what do you call it, wise old man, wise guy, you know. Services for him are at 1 o'clock on Wednesday at Havarash Shalom Synagogue.
All right.
So I just wanted to mention his passing and how much he'll be missed. You know, he was one of these guys who knew, like, he knew John.
He knew everybody.
He knew everybody, right. And he's extremely, extremely dedicated, continued his commitment. It's nice to see someone who sticks with it, who realizes they're right and stays with their being correct, as opposed to right, which is a political position. Am I getting incoherent? Yes.
No.
I don't know. So no all Abramoff all the time. Huh?
No all Abramoff all the time.
Okay, we got calls already.
Yeah, we do. Should we take a couple of these?
Let's take a couple.
Before we do, I want to touch on what you just said. It's going to lead me into the Supreme Court.
A segue? Oh, let's have a segue.
A transition.
And then we'll go to Richard.
All right. You want to hear the segue first? Okay, that's fine. You just mentioned semi-private sector people interfering with the formation of international policy.
Yeah.
Well, I want to point to a particularly egregious example of that, one that we've talked about on this program before, and that was the journey made in 1980 during the campaign season by George H.W. Bush to Paris to meet with representatives of the Iranian government to arrange for the release of the Iranian hostages on the day of President Reagan's inauguration.
Right.
The October surprise.
Exactly.
The original October surprise.
Right.
Well, as it turns out, quite a few people at the time either were aware of or were suspicious of the hanky-panky that went on here. And this percolated its way through Congress. And finally, during the first and only term of President George H.W. Bush, the Senate wanted to launch a full-scale investigation of the October surprise.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to that?
I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
It was stopped by the then minority Republicans in the Senate. You want to know how they did it?
Yes, I do.
With a filibuster.
No.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The Republicans used a filibuster?
A filibuster to stop the legitimate investigation of an unconstitutional violation of the powers of the executive.
Why do the Republicans hate America so much?
That's a very good question, Joe. But that brings me around to today, or rather, more importantly, to yesterday, in which there was a very half-assed attempt at a filibuster in Senate to stop the nomination of Sam Alito, whom everybody knows is going to turn the Supreme Court into nothing more than a rubber stamp for the Bush administration, even more so than it is now.
Even despite the fact that the Supreme Court, in a payoff to the Bush family, essentially in 2000 gave the presidency to Georgie Porgy?
Right. So it's going to further entrench that sort of ideological bend on the Supreme Court. If there was ever time for a full-assed filibuster, it was yesterday, and the Democrats couldn't do it. So in answer to your question earlier, where the hell are the Democrats, who the hell knows? Who the hell knows? It's never going to be easier for them to be an opposition party. Have they managed to do it? No, they have not. With a very few exceptions, this has been a very wussy, very invertebrate bunch of would-be opposition party members.
And when you look at the National Endowment for Democracy and the International Republican Institute and the International Democratic Institute and all these other things which are semi-sponsored by the U.S. government and semi-responsible to the U.S. government and semi-irresponsible and able to carry out policy for America without being official, when you look at those and you realize that they are bipartisan, and you suddenly get some sense that, the parties are just a game. What's really interesting about this Bush administration is, to the amazement of the Democrats, they're not kidding. It's not just a game for them. They're on a fascist course.
No. They're looking to establish one-party rule for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, but no combination. It's just them.
Just them. One part. That's why I said one-party rule. One party meaning in combination with no other party.
All right. Now, 2318187, we're going to go to Richard. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Really enjoy the show. First-time caller. I have a comment and a question.
Sure.
You've had this theme, where are the Democrats?
Right.
And I just wanted to say that there was a great interview with Noam Chomsky on Alternet. The title of the interview is There Is No War on Terror. And he further talks about what the problem with the Democrats is. Since they take money from the same people as the Republicans, how can they have any fundamental differences in their policies, and how can they attack the Republicans? Because then they'd be attacking the people that they need money for to get reelected.
Bingo.
Yeah. In a certain respect, it's a question of degree. Yes, the Democrats take money from the same sorts of people. But, and this has been especially true in recent years now that the Abramoff/Delay lobbyist machine has taken over Washington, they don't take as much money. This was especially delineated in the elections that propelled Bill Clinton to office in 1992 and 1996. These figures are approximate based on memory here, but the corporate money was split approximately 2-1 Republicans over Democrats. And the difference was made up by the Democrats in terms of labor contributions. So if you're looking... If you're looking in absolute terms, yes, the money is coming from the same places. However, more of the Democrats' money is coming from the right kind of places, if you will, meaning labor organizations and not corporations. But that's about all I can say in defense of the Democrats. They're corrupt as well.
Yeah. And my question is, of these independent organizations, how do they get federal funding if they're some sort of... non-governmental agency.
Well, they got seed money from Congress. Initially, $18.5 million. Now it's up to I think $40 million. And how they do that is it gets passed as quietly as legislation, and that's how they do it. And nobody really pays attention. Most Americans regard politics as somebody else's game. So they don't pay attention. The press, of course, has the position of the Oregonian. What you don't know won't hurt the Oregonian. You follow me?
Yeah. Well, thank you, guys. Keep it up.
Thank you, Richard.
And, of course, this stuff is, it is published in the left-wing press. But one of the things that characterizes American politics, two things that characterize American life and politics today. Most Americans are cynical and consider politics somebody else's game. They pay no attention to it. Or when they do, it's a kind of an ignorant paying attention. That's number one. And number two, and I think this is really extremely important to understand, basically... It is a game of the haves. And when you talk about labor money and the role of organized labor in politics, until these particular Republicans, organized labor had, beginning in the late 40s and early 50s, rather than deciding to become a political entity on their own, like a labor party in Europe, you know, social Democrats or communists, God forbid, or the labor party, the old labor party in England, which is gone, instead of being like that, where they become the loyal opposition, essentially, they put their stock in the Democrats because they came out of the tradition of the New Deal.
Yeah. And that was a good move for a long time.
Well,
except
that what they did was they ended up, instead of looking for corporatism, instead of looking toward the corporatism of a cooperation of labor and management and government, which...
Yeah, a cooperatism?
Cooperativism? Corporatism, yeah, actually, is the term. Anyway, instead of that, they looked to struggle for the rights of workers. And it worked. CIO unions, AFL unions ended up getting very good deals, including benefits, you know, retirement, health care, and so on. And that held until the crisis of today. Now, because they never institutionalized those as part of a national health care system and a national retirement system beyond Social Security, they were very vulnerable. As the economy began to become a little less strong, it immediately became possible for the Exxons and the Fords and the General Motors and so on, and the Verizons and whatnot, to roll back those benefits.
Pensions and health care.
Exactly.
Those dominoes have started to fall.
Exactly. And to take them away, and there's nothing to replace them, and there's no aware constituency to insist that this be taken up as part of the programs of the national government.
And of course, it goes without saying, this has all happened during a period when executive compensation has grown exponentially.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The rich get richer and the poor get not just children, but screwed over.
Yeah.
And this is really happening. What makes these Republicans so different from the old Republicans is there was a kind of quid pro quo of sharing of power within the elites of the Republican and Democratic Party. This group of Republicans are into their own personal agenda, which essentially would exclude the liberal arms of the Republican Party and, of course, the Democrats. And these guys are, I believe, fascists.
Yeah. And as we've talked on the show many times, it's a symptom of a larger modal global economic shift. And that is the transition of ultimate power from nation states to transnational corporations.
Right. Of course, the ones that will prevail, the American elites hope, will be American-directed corporations.
Yeah, but that designation is starting to mean less and less.
That's true. Just follow the money. It's very sad. But what is so significant in all of this is the American people's almost a systematic and deliberate effort to disillusion them about the ability of government to perform the services that are necessary for people to do well in this world. Therefore, people withdraw from politics entirely. The great majority of Americans who are eligible no longer vote.
And there's also been a great deal of effort put in over the years to framing the terms of the discourse. Look at the discussion that surrounded, for example, the recent controversies regarding United Airlines' revocation of worker pensions, for example, or of General Motors' recent scaling back of healthcare plans. The discourse went like this. It's labor's fault because they want too much in wages, they want too much healthcare, they want too much retirement.
Exactly, and one of the most interesting discussions that's taking place in Oregon and elsewhere, in every state actually, is the fact that the most active unionization and ability to insist on decent compensation, decent retirement, decent health care has come from the public sector. So what does the public tend to do? It looks at its tax bill, which it always perceives as too high and frequently is, and says, hey, these public sector workers are getting too good a deal.
They're parasites.
They're parasites, exactly. And instead of saying, which one might, hey, if they got such a good deal, why can't I have such a good deal? I should demand such a good deal
and
organize. Instead, they say, let's take the compensation, let's take the benefits, let's take the retirement away from the public sector so we can all have a lousy situation.
Yeah, it's almost become fetishized.
Yeah.
You see attacks on both in this state and in California are two large examples of large public employment retirement funds that have grown largely through this skillful manipulation of employee-sponsored investments. Nothing more. A very well-managed mutual fund, if you will, on behalf of public employees. It's not taxpayer money. Well, it is indirectly. It's essentially portions of wages that are withheld and invested.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not as if those retirement funds represent a huge black hole into which taxpayer dollars are being shoveled. No, those were carefully managed growth funds that are paying off for their employees. But they've become the target of public ire.
Yeah, and that's manipulated, of course.
Of course.
And what we're seeing, of course, is the growth of this ability to manipulate almost every situation to the benefit of this ruling class. And, you know, most, as I say, most people barely pay attention, so when they surface a little bit, that's what they hear. That's the message. The message is hate the unions, the message is hate the public employees, the message is hate anyone who's in a better situation than you, except the ruling class. And for the most people, one simply envies them and wishes to be part of them and has a kind of mystical notion that somehow, despite the real situation people are in, they will get to be part of that.
Because this is America and that's what happens.
Because this is America right. And that's what's happening. I'm a kind of mystical, a religious statement.
And largely the message over the past few years has been fear the terrorists.
Right, and then that comes along very conveniently to create the sense of the absolute need of all of this. Now, is this changeable? That's an interesting question. That's why it's so important to have constant political agitation and information that is accurate and true about what's really going on, no matter what. So, in that interest, you know, today is Bush's State of the Union,
mm-hmm.
or State of the Disunion, as I would say. There's actually going to be some actions that people, you know, the hip kind of crowd might want to be part of. The title is State of the Emergency. It's an update. Things are going to get noisy in Portland this afternoon. It says here there will be people banging drums, pots and pans, singing, chanting, and yelling throughout Portland come 6 p.m. World Can't Wait is organizing, I think I mentioned this some time ago, a massive protest all across the country to coincide with the State of the Union. State of Emergency, and it's happening simultaneously in cities all across the U.S. In Portland, there's a gathering at Pioneer Square starting at 4, including a local band called Sand People. From there, marches will be led throughout Portland neighborhoods with the goal of drowning out Bush as he attempts to deliver his address. Well, that's symbolic, you know. That's when things will get noisy. By 6 p.m., there will be Portlanders marching all over town in groups, bringing with them their voices and calling their neighbors to come away from their television sets and join the march. Most people, of course, will not even be watching the State of the Union. There are other related community events being planned. You can contact Portland Can't Wait. Email address is portland@worldcantwait.org or 206-666-BUSH. That's 666-2874. Anyway, that's something that's actually happening and is worthwhile participating in. And we have underwriters. Did you know that?
Yeah, we do.
Well, we got the film,
Real Dirt on Farmer John.
The Real Dirt on Farmer John, which is playing at the...
Cinema 21.
Cinema 21. And people ought to go to that.
They should.
We like the film. And did you bring it back to me?
No.
Okay, well, somewhere out there is a copy of that film. And I thought it was a great film, and I thought Farmer John was a great interview, which we did.
Yeah, I thought so.
I think people should go see that movie. I think it's about an alternative. And this is relevant to what we were talking about earlier. There are ways to establish alternative institutions in the face of this putsch by the Republican, the new so-called Republicans. They aren't really the Republicans. They're the kind of fascist Republicans.
Yeah.
So, you know, the alternative institutions are very important as a demonstration of what could be in America without great deal of pain.
Yeah. So what is our fearless leader going to talk about tonight?
Oh,
healthcare.
Healthcare.
What is he going to talk about?
He's going to talk about it. He's going to talk about the most complex privatized system of healthcare.
I heard something on the radio on this subject this morning that just made me fall out of my chair.
Really?
Well, not really, no. But it made
me
spinal
injury? Can we sue the station?
There was an industry flack talking about the president's healthcare proposition he's going to make tonight.
Yeah.
And the emphasis that he was making was all about consumer-driven healthcare choices. And meaning the idea is to take some of the burden of providing healthcare off employers, where in my opinion it shouldn't have been in the first place, and placing it onto consumers. And this was the way this guy framed it. He said, when you place more of this burden upon a consumer,
mm-hmm.
There is more of an impetus to control costs because each consumer is going to be saying, okay, where can I get the most savings for my health care dollar?
Or, well, I'll just put off my teeth till they...
Right. Translation, which procedure will I have to skip because I don't have enough money to afford it? That is consumer-driven healthcare choices.
Well, and as it happens, the head of OHSU, right, Kohler, uh-huh. Peter Kohler, Mr. Bus in the Sky Kohler, right, mm-hmm. he wants to create a test case for healthcare delivery in which you never see a doctor. You know, you see a physician's assistant, maybe. You fill out a form. It goes through a computer. He wants to create two simultaneous healthcare systems, just like we have two simultaneous wage systems. And I wanted to mention one other thing. The decision of unions to essentially make things good for their workers created a multi-tier wage system in America, with the privileged, many of whom are in labor unions, and the less privileged, those who are outside that system. Mm-hmm. And the same thing will apply to healthcare. It does, but Kohler wants to formalize it with a test case in Oregon. Initially 5,000 Oregonians on the Medicare Medicaid system and 5,000 Oregonians on his new computer high-tech system where you don't see a doctor until it's necessary.
What do you talk to the RoboDoc 2000?
Yeah, talk to the RoboDoc.
Oh, great.
I mean, this is serious. This is a serious dumbing down and making worse our health care system.
And this man's the head of a major health research organization?
But he's retiring.
Oh.
So there's some...
he's going to be replaced...
There's hope, yeah.
He's going to be replaced by the RoboPres 2000.
Yeah, and of course he got the flying bus up to the hill from the river, which we will probably have to pay for.
Right. I kind of like
that. We got lots of calls. 231-8187.
Who do we have, Eduardo?
Mark.
Good morning. Hello, Mark. You're next on the Abe and Joe Show. Good morning.
Well, maybe not.
Maybe not. Who's next? Joe. Hello. Joe. It's a recurring theme here.
What, the silence?
Yes.
The long, hard silence. We know the board is full of people.
It's the aching silence of a public yearning to be free. Paul, good morning. See? More aching silence. All right.
Well, they all got bored with us, man.
Yeah, I guess so.
They don't understand.
Well, keep trying. We'll get you through. 231-8187 is the number to call.
Yeah, I think what is interesting about all of this is there's all kinds of initiatives essentially I look at this. I hate conspiracy theories. Okay, but you know there's this Club of Rome stuff. Going back, what, to the 70s?
Do you hate conspiracy theories, or do you hate people theories that people might call conspiracy theories?
No, I hate the idea that there might be conspiracies, but I also hate the idea that people jump on these conspiracy theories rather than looking at things as they are.
Do you understand, though, that as soon as someone says the word conspiracy theory, that allows everybody to just simply write off whatever's being discussed?
So I shouldn't do that?
No, you shouldn't.
So I should say that, you know, there was this report on the Club of Rome, which was, you know, all the wise
right.
men.
Right, and then you can say something like, I don't know if this is true.
Oh, okay. But there was this Club of Rome report, and what it essentially said was that in the West, people have too good a standard of living, and as resources dwindle, in order for the wealthy and powerful to continue to have all the stuff they have, we're going to have to reduce the standard of living of ordinary people. And you know what? That's what's happening.
Yeah, that's true.
Funny coincidence, that.
That's going to be one of history's big ironies, though, because what's been driving global capitalism and enriching the new emerging transnational executive class is consumer demand from the Western industrialized nations. If you impoverish those people, who's going to buy your global
stuff?
Capitalist products? Yeah.
Well, the Chinese, the Indians.
Okay, so we're gonna reduce the standard of living for Westerners and increase it for Easterners, but never up to the point that the Westerners used to occupy.
No, of course not.
Okay, so you're going to have sort of this global underclass that believes it's really the new middle class.
Well, it will be the new middle class because middle will sink to low.
But the middle becomes irrelevant.
Well,
but we're going to persist in the myth of the middle class because people need to have that, right?
Yeah. Our children, or at least our children's children, will not have as good a standard of living as we have. For one thing, the environment will be degraded enormously. For another, things that we took for granted, like home ownership and so on, will be problematic, except for those of us who are extremely privileged.
Oh, I see.
And actually, you know, it'll be like science fiction. A very crowded world, you know, John Brunner kind of world. Mm-hmm. Very crowded world.
Dog eat dog.
Dog eat dog.
Person eat person.
Nasty, nasty, nasty. Yeah. With the skies that are constantly polluted, and groundwater that's polluted, and the rising seas, and all that kind of science fiction stuff will actually come true.
Uh-huh.
Cool.
Yeah, so the ruling class will have ever lengthening lifespans, and everybody else will have ever shortening lifespans.
Right. I mean, I'm actually put in mind of Soylent Green. That is where the rich have essentially a domed and protected luxurious space, and everybody else is like, like India at its worst. With food riots and stuff.
Why do you hate America so much?
No, you hate America so much. I think it's very serious. I think it's very, very real. I think that people need to get wise. I think it's still something that can be changed. Barring a change in the political structure, what's going to happen is the great crash of all of this will occur environmentally.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
Well, maybe you'll be wrong, Joe. Maybe that global event will be the force that unifies everyone in everyone's own interest.
Yeah, GM
collective
can get
interest.
Well, GM can get into boat building,
Sure. Yeah.
Arcs. There'll be lots of arcs.
Yeah.
Everybody floating around in their little arc.
There'll be a boom in the surfboard industry.
Well, yeah. See, there's always a possibility to make money. Nothing. No desperation here. All right. 231-8187. Dark times, man.
Your West Hills house will now be beachfront property.
Yes. See? More valuable than ever. Oh, I don't know.
231-8187. I want to talk about ExxonMobil.
Do you insist on talking about ExxonMobil?
Yeah, okay, well, let's go to the phones.
231-8187. Maybe the phones are working. Who do we got? Paul.
Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Hello.
Can you hear me this time?
Whoa,
yeah.
Boy,
okay.
Can we ever.
Yep.
Good, good. So I'll turn the modulation down a little bit.
Okay. 10-4, good buddy. Go
okay, so all politics is local. And
except when it isn't.
Yeah, well, so if people, getting down to the local level, if people in North Portland don't want to watch the idiot tonight, they can go to the Kenton Firehouse and the North Portland Greenway Trail Group. We're going to be having a public meeting there. We're a group of people trying to connect Cathedral Park to the East Bank Esplanade.
No, you cannot do that. You are poor people. You cannot be connected to
That's
this environmental.
Idea.
No. Bad. Ordinary people connected to the environmentally beautiful? Never.
Yeah, well, Joe, see the facts I sent Kathleen after you get off the show.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's go to Haiti for a minute.
Okay.
Thomas Jefferson was responsible for putting such onerously burdensome reparations on Haiti that they had to pay reparations to France, and it kept them bankrupt for centuries.
That's true, actually. You're right.
Yeah. And then there's always the local connection. I don't know, did you all not catch 2 or 3 days ago, I guess it was on NPR, Mark Croker gave a report from Haiti.
Mark Croker?
Yeah,
the former police chief?
Our man from the CIA, they figured they got us in Portland tame, so they sent him off to Haiti.
Mark Croker in Haiti. I love it.
Mm-hmm. But for all the people that are dissatisfied with the way the Democratic Party is going,
yes,
there is an alternative.
What is that?
At the moment. Well, Monday night at 7 p.m. at the Sunnyside School Library, 3421 Southeast Fish Street. You know where that is?
No.
It's in between
Belmont and Hawthorne.
Right, right. Yeah. Some people call it Salmon. I like to call it Fish Street.
Oh, Salmon.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks for clearing that up.
Yeah, but it's Pete Sorensen's going to be there. You know about Pete Sorensen?
You tell us.
Pete Sorensen is this Democrat. He's a fairly darn progressive guy, and he's fed up with the way Kulongoski's been stabbing people in the back, and he's decided to run for governor. So he's going to run against what's-his-face in the Democratic primary. So if you want to find out, there are a few people here in Oregon who actually are progressive,
mm-hmm.
and they're still D's, and they haven't totally thrown in the towel yet. And, this Pete Sorensen, he's a pretty cool dude. He's got his a progressive agenda. And so Monday, February 6th, 7 p.m., Sunnyside School Library. I think they might call that the Environmental Middle School now. I'm not sure. But it's 3421 Southeast Salmon Street in Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
All right.
Sounds like something worthwhile.
Yeah.
Paul is our a local rep. We're going to have to designate people to have official positions so we sound, important.
He's our inner-southeast bureau chief?
Well, he's our North Portland a reporter.
Oh, okay.
And one of the issues that he has raised very importantly is the way the way the board what's it called? The Metropolitan, what is it?
Metro.
Metro.
Mm-hmm.
Metro. The way Metro has sort of apparently cut off North Portland from access to the natural areas around, near them. Not building the trails and so on.
Smith and Bybee Lakes.
Yeah, and all that. Well, you know, poor people mostly, and, you know, working class people. They don't need to see ducks. They don't need to see blue herons.
No.
No. I think that stuff should be reserved for people who drive there.
Of course.
Yeah, in their SUVs.
You don't want to walk there. Come on.
Yeah,
or
really,
bike there.
Or bike there. No, that's no good. All right, 231-8187. Hey, Mark, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Hey, I'm back. I got cut off. A long time ago, I heard Dan Rather supporting Bush and the war by saying he's my commander-in-chief. And that's a false statement, and it's been used by the Republicans to justify Bush's domestic spying, saying that, you know, he was authorized to use force, and he's the commander-in-chief. He's not the commander-in-chief of the U.S., he's commander-in-chief of the Army, and that would only be if he was legitimately elected president, which he wasn't, so he's nothing. And he's not the commander-in-chief of
you and me.
Of you and me.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
And the other thing is, yesterday, I believe it was on Democracy Now!, I heard a little fact that seems to have slipped below the radar again. They said Halliburton is creating detention facilities around the United States with a very large capacity, and they were asked why they were doing this, and they said, well, this is in case we have a large influx of immigrants. Come on, folks. They're building concentration camps.
Well, you know, it's interesting you raise that. Back in the bad old days of the anti-communist crusades, as it were, McCarran Act and others actually created concentration camps out of the old Japanese-American internment camps.
Yeah.
And those were kind of supposedly decommissioned. But what you're saying is that now the private prison industry is rebuilding and redeveloping those. I didn't hear that particular part of Democracy Now!, but
well, it may have been on Air America, other part
but,
of it.
But be that as it may, assuming you're correct, which would not surprise me, you know. Which
well, I didn't make it up. I heard it yesterday.
Okay, I believe you. I believe you. Anyway, this is part and parcel of the process of the fascistification of America, the pacification of America, if it will. The irony is that the pacification of America has already been accomplished through the consumer culture and the entertaining us to death. And this is kind of the last stages, I'm afraid. Harry Belafonte was on
I heard him, yeah.
Democracy Now! It was very good, talking actually about Haiti, among other things.
Yeah. Well, I will not go quietly. If they come with their cattle trucks and military, I'll make them shoot me in the bus station. I'm not going to get on no train.
What part of you is the bus station?
Bus station to the concentration camp.
Oh, I see. You're gonna go down. Go down fighting.
Yeah.
Well, this is a part of the Second Amendment thinking. You know, me and my gun. They'll pry my gun from my whatever.
The
thing about that is that we all think we will offer great resistance, at least verbally. No, we'll say. But the fact of the matter is that a totally pacified nation wouldn't even notice.
Yeah.
Besides which, we have drugs for that.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, but do not despair. Okay. Do not despair. Democracy can be alive and can function in America. It's still possible. We still have the potential to be a aware people. There is still a possibility of a real politics in America.
I agree.
And thank you for the call.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. You know, in addition to the plan involving the former Japanese-American internment camps.
And other stuff like that.
And other stuff like that. Yeah, more... another series.
That's for
of
Mexicans,
though. Yeah, another series of camps was built, particularly in the South, to contain what the government feared would be an armed insurrection of African Americans.
Really?
Yeah, there are plans in place, administered by FEMA, no less, to incarcerate millions of African Americans. Would there have ever been an uprising?
Dude, you're making me feel very paranoid.
That's true.
All right, 231-8187. Who do we got?
Do we have Eduardo?
Do we have anyone? Maybe we don't have anyone. Maybe
hello?
Don't.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hello? Who are we talking to?
This is
Shamu?
Yes.
Hey,
oh,
how are you?
Good. Thank you for the show. Good to talk to you guys. I just had two comments. One was regarding the previous caller. He mentioned Amy Goodman's show,
mm-hmm.
and he mentioned the fact that there were contracts going out to Halliburton for building... prison camps, and that is correct. She did say that in the first 5 minutes of her news.
Thank you.
The second thing is you mentioned in the previous discussion you were talking about transnational executives across the globe,
mm-hmm.
and then you mentioned about India and China and their executives too. I'm from India, and I just wanted to make one comment. There is this huge hullabaloo and news about how India and China are, you know, rapidly advancing, quote unquote, and technology is just going through the roof, and standards of living are becoming like paradise in India and all that stuff. I want to put into perspective, one of the poorest countries in the world is still India,
uh-huh.
even though mm-hmm. there is so much technology and there's so much advancement in sciences and in industry. If you travel about 10 miles out of Bangalore, which is now going to be the next IT Silicon City of the world,
mm-hmm.
you'll come across villages where there is no running water supply, there is no electricity, there is no basic hygiene services, there are no hospitals. And other cities like Delhi, Bombay, Madras, Calcutta, Hyderabad, which are supposed to be the, you know, hotbeds of technology and advancement and shopping malls and all that stuff. If you just have to travel 10 miles, 15 miles, or 20 miles out into the suburbs, and you'll see a huge gaping difference of the standards of living. So, yes, there is a flow of capital going on there, and there is a huge market that's being exploited by transnational corporations, but it's for a small middle class there. Out of the 1 billion, I think 80-85% still live under very severe poverty conditions.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because the same is true for China, only perhaps in many ways more severe. As you may know, this is not true so much for India, but it's definitely true for China. There is vast unrest in China. There have been thousands, literally thousands of strikes and demonstrations and fights. The government is constantly putting down unrest, particularly in the smaller cities, in the interior and in rural areas. And in fact, most Chinese people are not experiencing this great boom. What is happening, which is characteristic of developing nations, including India, is that lots of people leave the farm because of the desperate conditions under which they exist and go to the cities, where they end up in terrible poverty, hoping for the off chance that they will get the opportunity to participate in this middle-class boom, which often doesn't happen.
That's absolutely correct. That is very correct. And the government, the communist government, local governments are encouraging land grabbing by the farmers there.
Yeah.
And that's happening in India too. There was a huge demonstration against Coke in the southern state of Kerala.
Uh-huh.
Coke bought thousands of acres of agricultural land by bribing local authorities and set up a plant there, and then they let loose polluting chemicals into the neighboring farmland, and that killed their nutrients, and the farmers around the plant couldn't grow anything. And there was a huge outcry in the press, and then they shipped it to another state. So they're doing almost the same thing out there too.
You know, and the irony of Kerala, I mean, you mentioned it, is that at one time it was the model for social democracy in India, and it was actually run predominantly by the Indian Communist Party.
That's correct. Yes, that's correct. And it's still the highest literacy state. They're extremely politically conscious, and they just kicked out Coke from there.
And that's probably why.
Yes.
And they even had a decent healthcare system there, as I recall.
They have a very good healthcare system, free for all citizens of the state. Yes.
Now, this might be a very cynical assessment, but you mentioned that that despite the technological explosion in India, it's really only about 15% of the population that's able to function as a viable middle class. Is that right?
That is approximately correct.
Approximately correct.
Yes, there is a huge, massive surging middle class who are now going to glitzy shopping malls like the ones you have in the United States. They're buying Nike. They're buying Mercedes-Benzes, they're buying Toyotas, and so there's an inflated economy going on there which is depending on these imported luxury items and having and living in multi-storied apartment complexes which are you know, polluting swimming pools on their roofs, and that's causing an environmental degradation. The Hyderabad, the city which had so much water before, is now under severe water shortage because of the large number of IT, international IT setups there, and they're all drawing water from underneath the surface.
Now, what I think is happening here in the eyes of the emerging transnational executive elite is this. If you're talking about perhaps India's middle class only represents 15% of the population, but 15% of a population of 1 billion might be more than enough to replace the diminishing purchasing power being experienced by Western middle class people. So that's a very cynical assessment, but I would lay money that that's what's going on in the minds of the transnational corporate elite.
Oh, definitely, yes. Yeah. And not only that, they're entering into government too. Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, Nike, Victoria's Secret. In my childhood, I could not imagine thinking of Victoria's Secret putting out huge hoarding ads all across the country. And they're encouraging all this to go on. And they're ripping off agricultural land. Farmers are committing suicide in the state of Andhra Pradesh, which is the home of Hyderabad, because Monsanto sold seeds there, and it's a mess going on out there. There's going to be a crash sometime soon.
I think you're making a very good point, and the question of whether there will be an environmental crash is part of what I'm interested in. But I also, you know, the whole concept of from bras to bombers being dumped in essence upon the developing world, the model being one instead of one of alternatives, ecologically sound development, and so on and so on. This this rush to capitalism, as it were, seems to me to be a great tragedy, the greatest tragedy of this. Of this current era,
right.
And I see this everywhere, and I see the environmental degradation that's taking place everywhere.
Right.
I wonder though if it isn't the case that the contradiction between the growing surge of markets and product production and so on in these parts of the world don't in the end mean a great challenge to countries in the West, particularly the United States, which may in and of itself bring about the mechanisms of social change here. I don't know.
Why do you think it's a challenge?
Well, I think that at some point the American people will not be able to afford the very products that are being produced in these markets, and that in essence the whole of capitalism will shift to Asia.
Yes, I agree to that extent. And then what's going to happen is the whole model is now being shifted to those countries. So after maybe 50 years, the economies in those countries will collapse because. Of the same reasons that you just said, and the capitalist economy will shift to other cheaper countries in probably Africa or somewhere.
Ah, yes. Of course, there's still Africa to exploit.
Right, right. Thank you very much for taking the call. I'll listen to you offline.
Yeah, I really appreciate the call.
Yeah, wonderful insights there.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, great phone call.
It's a good call. I think that, we talk about all this stuff, and I find us falling into the gloom and doom.
Well, it's really hard not to, Joe. It's really hard not to. Really, if we're going to extricate ourselves,
yes,
as a species,
yeah,
let's face it, and that's what we're looking at,
yeah,
as a species from the problem we're creating, it's going to require the exercise of altruism on a grand scale. And let's face it, altruism is not hardwired into primate behavior.
Oh, come on.
It is not. So it's going to take us consciously acting in a way that we have not been evolutionarily conditioned to act in.
Ooh, downer, bummer, man.
I'm not saying it can't be done, but it's going to take a collective decision made by everybody to do things differently. And that is a very hard sell.
Even if what you say is true, which it probably is, even if what you say is true, there is the fact that we are conscious beings and that there is the existential necessity for right behavior. This is taught by Buddhism. It's taught by all the major religions of the world. It is as ethical as distinct from supernatural ideas. It is also something that makes absolute sense in an ecological way. I do not think human beings are incapable of waking up and realizing what's going on. The challenge is that there has to be a lot of good women and men really struggling, even though it seems like, you can never tell when that tipping point occurs. You have to keep struggling. And that's something that people have to be aware of and have to keep doing. If every one of our listeners devoted one day a week to social change, to the mechanisms of justice, to fairness, to nonviolent resistance, we would see a significant change even in Oregon. I believe that. I believe that's true nationally. I believe it's true transnationally. And I believe it's possible. I don't believe it's likely, but I think it's possible.
Yeah, I would like to think that it is possible, but you're asking a great deal in an era of unprecedented and unparalleled manipulation of symbols and language. For example, yes, there is an existential need for compassion and altruism built into every moral code and every civilization on the planet. However, we exist in an
era... So how can you say that's not hardwired if it's existing in every culture?
It is built into the moral codes that we have constructed, and those moral codes, their primary purpose is to facilitate the peaceful interaction of people with one another. So ostensibly for the prosperity of everyone. But in practice, usually for the prosperity of a very few. Now we're in an age where lip service can be paid to those ideals. You can be, for example, a compassionate conservative, or claim that you are, and win the presidency, or claim that you won the presidency. You can wage an illegal and immoral war abroad and claim it's in the name of democracy, when all that's being done here is lip service paid to these existential ideals that we all possess. But in reality, it's a much, much more cynical and grasping situation.
Let's take some calls. 231-8187. Eli, you're on the air.
Hi. I just heard you talking about the species and the moves that we have to make as a species in order to survive. And,
yeah.
I'm really fascinated with this idea of survival of the human species, and I was wondering if you guys have heard of or are interested in the extraterrestrial imperative.
I don't know a thing about the extraterrestrial imperative.
Is that what we do with the aliens, tell us?
Not at all. but the idea is that the wording of the actual document, I'm not sure I agree with 100%, but the idea is that if we are to survive as a species, at some point, the Earth will no longer sustain us.
The combination of the Gaia hypothesis and the ecological crisis.
That and also, the physics of solar mechanics.
How so?
The sun itself won't last forever.
Well, but man, we're talking a long time from now.
Yeah, certainly. But I mean, the species is, if that's something that we do hold dear, and it sounds like you do, and I do, then, the sun definitely has to be taken into account as well. I mean, it's a long-term perspective, but, obviously there are much more important shorter-term issues to a degree, but I think it's something to consider.
Well, thank you for the call.
No problem. Thank you.
I'm of two minds about this. On the one hand, I'm entranced and romanced by the idea of moving off the planet and exploring and settling elsewhere.
No go.
But on the other hand, the expression of that impulse is one that runs counter to the choice towards altruism I just talked about. That's simply using the rest of the universe as a safety valve for our worst impulses. So in that respect, I'm not on board. But when I talk about the choices we need to make for the survival of the species, that in and of itself is a conceit. Yes, it is self-interest. I want our species to survive because I want our civilization and our culture to survive. Because, let's face it, if we wipe ourselves from the face of the planet, life will go on. The ecosystem will go on. Evolution will continue to happen. The only difference is that we won't be around. And so, yeah, it's species self-interest. I want very much for us to continue to be around. That's where I'm coming from.
Even when it produces the evils of Bush Cheney?
I want us to move beyond the evils of Bush-Cheney, and that's going to take a collective choice in the direction of altruism that I just talked about, as primates, we are not inclined to do.
I think people should take their pots and pans and go out around 6 o'clock and beat them.
That would be noisy.
I also think people should ride on the sidewalk. And I think that people, again, I think that people need to take one day in seven, in the old Talmudic sense, and one day in seven, instead of having a day of rest, a day of work for the community. It can be planting things, it can be resistance, it can be making signs, it can be political action. At least one day in seven,
or even just community togetherness.
I think it's possible that we can change.
Even rounding up your neighbors for a soccer game is a beneficial act, an altruistic act,
if it's put into a conscious context.
Yeah.
But, I think
anything to get people off of electronic modes of entertainment and interacting with each other.
I think it's possible that things can go well.
I think it's possible. But it's going to take a choice, an active choice.
And then of course, there's the news media, which has an absolute way it frames every issue around the current administration is just amazing.
It is.
Just amazing.
I want to talk about Exxon. Why don't you go ahead and read those?
I'm going to do this. I'm going to take care of some business. Okay, I got to tell you that Between the Covers, it's a special extended edition. Extended edition featuring award-winning journalist J.R. Moringer, author of the memoir The Tender Bar, about growing up at the local bar, like, cocktails. Okay. And at 9:45, Scott Forrester, host of the Monday on the Environment, will be in for some environmental info. Is that true? We'll also have a movie review from Jay Thiemeyer. He reviews Down to the Bone, a film about recovery. Recovery, like, you know, from drugs and sex and rock and roll, I guess. Alcohol. At 10:30 on stage and studio, the topic is Miracle Theater's Men on the Verge of, On the Verge 2. Men on the Verge 2. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, Gore Vidal, one of my favorite authors, delivers his own traditional State of the Union address on patriotism, the National Security Agency, domestic surveillance programs, corporate America, presidential powers, and more. Gore Vidal is one of the guys who just hangs in there and keeps putting out the truth. Also, a Medicare recipient discusses the problems with the new system, which are manifold. A critic looks at Bush's energy policies prior to the speech by Bush. He thinks Bush can actually make his speech without too many fumbles. I think we ought to have a contest how many mistakes Bush makes. But anyway.
Maybe we could play a drinking game.
And African-American leaders reflect on the life of Coretta Scott King. All this and more on listener-supported radio, KBOO, 90.7 on your FM dial. Right now you're listening to me, Joe Uris, and my bud, Abe Proctor. This is Talk Radio. We do want to hear from you, 231-8187. And you want to talk
about... I want to talk about Exxon.
Exxon and then Will. Will, hang in there.
Hang in there, Will. We'll get to you in a second.
Okay.
All right, ExxonMobil.
ExxonMobil.
Which merged a few years back.
Yeah.
To form the world's largest oil corporation.
Yeah.
Just posted the largest quarterly, or actually the largest, first, the largest quarterly profits ever recorded and the largest yearly profits ever.
Why do you hate America so much?
Oh, here, I'm going to tell you why. No. I love America, Joe. We've been over this before.
Yes.
I love America. You love America. Our listeners love America. And that's why we're so pissed off. So don't give me that anymore.
Okay.
All
okay.
Right.
Where's the fun?
Exxon posted last quarter something like $10 billion in profits.
Well, yeah.
That means after, for a quick definition of profits, after all expenses are accounted for, they had $10 billion left over.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money. That's in one quarter.
You're just mad because they're not giving you any of it.
I wouldn't mind some of it. And that's
hey, I'm buyable. Yeah. Just give me $10 million and I'll shut up.
That's going to figure into this conversation as
okay.
well. All right, now what's interesting about this
yeah.
is Exxon immediately mounted a PR campaign to say a couple of things. First, they went on to say, well, it's really not that much. And secondly, they went on to say, well, our margin of profit is lesser, is smaller than a whole bunch of other industries, most notably pharmaceuticals and banks. And they did
I
this
believe
with,
it's like a 10% margin of profit. But anyway.
So they did this with full-page ads in major dailies.
Cool.
Saying, yeah, we made a lot of money, but percentage-wise, it's not as much as the drug companies and the banks.
Yeah.
So we're not so bad.
Yeah.
And here's another thing that they did that I find very interesting. Last quarter, they spent $5 billion, and this is, of course, an expense that figures in before they made their $10 billion profit. They spent $5 billion buying back stock from shareholders.
Ah.
And this is how they characterize it. They characterize it as rewarding the shareholders by buying their stock and enriching them. Now, one is forced to wonder in this situation, given that oil has never been more expensive than it is now.
Yeah.
Now that they've recorded the largest profits ever tallied by a corporation in the history of corporations.
Yeah.
Is it really an altruistic move on their part to buy back stock? Are they really rewarding their shareholders? Are they gathering more unto themselves to capitalize on the price of oil, which will no doubt continue to rise?
Is that like a rhetorical question?
That is a rhetorical question.
Okay. I think we should go to the phones.
No, I'm not
done
yet.
You're not done yet. Wait,
I'm not done
not
yet.
Not done yet. Not done yet, folks.
Okay, now, this is characteristic of a phenomenon that's happened since the Bushies came into office, and I haven't yet figured out a name for it, but this is how it works. A whole series of events will occur, all pointing towards one conclusion. And the Bushies and their cronies escape all this by saying one of two things. Either, oh, we didn't know, or, no, no, that's not what we're doing. Now, see, the whole series of events that's pointing in one direction are these. Record profits, stock buyback to enrich the ruling elite, a whole bunch of money paid to explain that they didn't really make all that much money. And thirdly, an illegal war that just happens to coincide with the raking in of record profits. All these things point toward a corruption on a massive scale, the doling out of rewards as a result of that corruption, and a move to sustain and perpetuate the conditions that led to those massive profits. But of course they're going to tell you, oh, we're not making as much as the banks and the pharmaceutical companies. And Bush will say, no, we didn't invade to control the oil. So while a whole bunch of facts are telling us one thing, they're telling us another, and there's really no debate going on about it. It's just fascinating.
It is amazing, and there is no loyal opposition or even disloyal opposition that gets much attention. One of the most amazing things about America today is that there is this growing dissatisfaction, but you would never know it from the media, and you would never, because it's all marginalized, and you would never know it, from stepping outside. That's why I want people to ride on the sidewalk. I want a little disorder.
A little chalk action.
A little chalk action. 231-8187, let's go out to Will, who's been very patient. Hi, Will.
Thank you, Will.
Hi.
Sorry about that. Go ahead.
No, that's good. That's good. I'd just like to put in a word for primates and say that I personally think that, you know, our inhumane behavior towards each other, if you will, mm-hmm. is a result of social conditioning and not of genetics.
I think you're right. I actually think you're right. But you know what? It's hard to test.
It's actually impossible to test because as individuals, we're like, now this is what we are. So, but that's just what I wanted to say. So
you're saying we are who we eat? That was a joke, man. You don't need to.
Yeah, okay.
Not a good one, I admit. But
well, anyway, that's it. So I'll go.
Thanks, Will.
Yeah.
You know, I like primates. I chose one for a mate. And I tend to think
gave up on that skunk you were running with?
Yes, right. It was a tough decision. I tend to think that that our bad behavior towards one another is both a result of our genetics and our social conditioning. That's what I tend to think. It's both nature and nurture. I talked about altruism not being hardwired into the primate.
I disagree with that.
Mindset. Well, back once upon a time, perhaps it was, but that altruism only extended as far as the group or the tribe. Your tribe, for example, was perfectly willing to go attack another tribe if they had a better hunting ground, for example. So maybe the question today is, who's a member of our tribe, and why doesn't the tribe include everyone? And perhaps we won't be able to find our way out of this mess until we decide that we're all part of the same group.
Yeah, and we all have to understand we're on this planet. It's a closed system. You know, all these things are necessary, but I think they're possible. I think we're running on a race against ecological disaster, a race against the worst qualities of human beings, mm-hmm. the kind of potential for authoritarian systems and fascism.
Yeah.
And of course, we don't have a media that's totally captured by the right wing weirdness. But we can resist.
We can. Well, I want to hear from some primates.
All right, 231-8187. If you're a primate, give us a call. Hi, Bill.
Are you a primate?
Yes, I am.
All right, let's hear it.
Well, you know, Joe, you were speaking about volunteering and mm-hmm. getting out, and it's an interesting thing because, you know, going back to the doom and gloom thing,
mm-hmm.
I was wondering if the dismantling of many of the social safety nets that we as a society have come to rely on can be the very thing that forces people back into their community. And let me give you an example. Before there was insurance, if a farmer's barn burned down, even if you hated him, other farmers showed up to help him rebuild. And that was because you never knew if your barn would burn down.
Mm-hmm.
Now we insulate ourselves in our homes and in our cars. And we really don't care about what goes on because we have insurances. We have the safety nets to a degree to where we don't have to worry about if our neighbor house burned down. Are we going to assist them? No, they have insurance for that. So I'm wondering if, if in fact the dismantling, by whomever in our government, if this could possibly be a turnaround that actually forces people back into the community setting and forces them to assist one another in the day-to-day things that we all rely on. And that's food, that's safety, that's all of the things that we've come to rely on government for, which are now breaking down.
Well, yeah, I in part I agree with you in this sense. In Scandinavia, for example, and other parts of Europe and in Africa and elsewhere, we do see the development of organizations, cooperatives, community development projects that are self-initiated. All these kinds of things do happen. I think, though, that we need to recognize that what we're dealing with is such a mega system of materialist selfishness that we have to actually be prepared to struggle against that as well as to develop these alternative institutions. But your point is an interesting one.
It's just a thought, and I'm wondering about many things as well. You know, we speak about where's the voice at in America. Well, I think shortly here when the baby boomers retire, if they don't have their pension plans, I think it's going to be called Revenge of the Hippies. and I think we'll possibly find people in the streets.
They'll put acid in the water, man.
So I'm wondering...
Bunch of wheelchairs and walkers.
Yes. Yeah, well, the one thing that you say, you speak of the material, and uh-huh. money being the vehicle that has allowed us to obtain this material...
Mm-hmm.
Once the money's gone, all we have is ourself and our voice. So, it's just a thought so that it's not all bad. And I'm trying to begin to see the good. And even though I know it's going to take effort
mm-hmm.
to, I guess, start to rebuild, not just this country, but the world. And I'm wondering if, in fact, they say you have to, they say an alcoholic has to hit rock bottom before they realize that the world, that things are just bad. And I'm wondering if that's just the slide that we're taking now as a society, and that it's not until it affects, those people who felt like they were insulated from all of this, that we begin to hear that voice in the media. And, I always see the poor people as the canaries in the mine.
Mm-hmm.
And then, lately it's been the poor people in the middle class. Well, when that so-called class of people who believe that they are wealthy and insulated begin to be attacked, I think we'll possibly begin to hear the voice that I think is absent in the media.
Well, I think it's interesting. I want to address that last point you made. The problem is always, as things collapse, do we move to a kind of authoritarian and fascist solution in which we become angry at each other and angry at the system at the same time the system gets more and more power? Or do we make an analysis that allows us to see our commonalities and to share in the process of change? I wanted to mention, in this context of all things, the film that we, and the guy we talked with, Farmer John, and the truth about Farmer John. Now, he is part of the community sustainable agriculture thing. His movie is at the Cinema 21. But the important thing about that work is the possibility of community-based agriculture. The problem with that is that programs like that largely serve people who are wealthier. The real issue is, can we extend healthy food, for example, to everyone? And I think it's possible, but it's going to be a real struggle. But these alternative institutions are the beginnings, the seeds, if you will, of another part of the process. And I think as the central political system does break down, all this is going to have to change. But you know what? We're echoing, and I got to let you
go. Okay,
thanks a lot for the call.
Now, you mentioned the choice we're making here between a fascistic sort of solution,
yeah.
if you want to call it that, and something else. What I think you omitted in your description of the fascistic solution is a fascist system requires an other at which to direct our collective anger.
Yes.
And the system doesn't work without sustaining that anger. And I think we can all clearly see that an other has been provided us by the fascists who are trying to take over, and that a surprising number of Americans have jumped on that wagon.
Well, and that other isn't just, for example, the Islamic extremist fundamentalists. That other becomes anybody who says, well, maybe this isn't the best way to deal with this.
Right. Liberals.
Liberals.
Or immigrants.
Yeah.
Or terrorists.
Yeah.
Or communists, or what have you.
Yeah.
Anyone who essentially who's not a middle-class white Anglo-Saxon Protestant.
Well, I'm not even sure you have to be a Protestant, just a Christian. Oh.
Well, yeah, I guess there has been some progress. You can be a Catholic now, too.
Well,
or a Mormon.
Some Catholics, some Mormons. But no, that's true. I think that the definition of us and them, which is what you're talking about, that
mm-hmm.
sliding scale,
yes.
is very much a part of the what's at play. And people are very desperately aware of that, and they want to be part of us, not them.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of reactionary force that leads to further fascism.
Yeah, and as we were just speaking, as primates, perhaps we won't find our way out of this mess until we decide we're all in the same tribe.
And perhaps we won't find ourselves out of this mess until we're all in the mess.
Yeah, perhaps.
But I don't know. I'm still hopeful, and I still believe that it's possible. I still believe, that one of the ironies is about America is that it was the first modern democracy, and therefore it has a lot of foibles and faults in its system. People don't like to talk about this, that were repaired through struggle and change and world wars in Europe. So our model is a little antiquated in some ways.
It is.
And it'll be interesting to see if we can make some changes structurally that could reignite a democratic process.
But it's very difficult to even make that suggestion because then you're questioning dogma. You know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying.
That's a very difficult thing to do.
231-8187. Steve, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Steve, good morning.
Oh, he's not
Steve.
There. He's not there. It's just our phone system.
Richard.
Hey, Richard, you're on the air, we think.
I hope so.
Okay,
good.
I'm not even
going to take time to turn down my radio if it's not feeding back.
Good idea, because we had the echo problem just the last call.
We can hear you. Go for it.
Well, before we try to relate, I'm hoping that I can get an idea of what a conspiracy is that Joe doesn't particularly relate to.
Well, my opinion is that Joe recoils from something being labeled a conspiracy theory because such a label tends to invalidate an argument in the eyes of other people.
All right. Well, let's forget the labels.
Maybe I'm wrong about that.
Let's forget the labels. Let's look at long-term planning by people that most of us have never met.
Oh, that's nicely put. I like that. Go ahead for it.
Well, there is a lot of that going on around us.
Does seem so.
The plan is stretching out into the future.
Yeah.
And we heard a little bit about how Mr. Halliburton is contributing to that plan at this point.
Mr. Halliburton, I like that.
Anyway, I don't think that we are going to be able to pull out of our tailspin into the crash unless something different than what we've been talking about happens, and that is that we have to become aware of the long-term planning of others, and we have to develop a long-term plan. We cannot just merely be reactionary.
Mm-hmm.
We can't just say, look, open your eyes and look around you and resist. That's not going to do it. We have to first know who we are in relation to others, and particularly who we are in relation to our institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to realize how our ignorance has been exploited. Our ignorance is not only massive, but it is part of the long-term planning of the others. And I want to, you know, I don't have nearly enough time in 10 minutes.
Well, you don't even have 10 minutes, so go.
You know, through the end of this segment, I don't have enough time. But
yeah.
I will give you this about the effectiveness of long-term planning, and hopefully I'll be able to continue this some other time.
I hope so.
In Oregon, we have a law in the books since 1927, which in order to foster citizenship said that schools will provide a course in constitutional studies every year commencing no later than the eighth grade and continuing through college graduation, and it will also be taught in institutions and prisons.
I didn't know that.
Well, most of us don't, but it's in the book today.
Huh.
It's still there today, but nobody is getting what the law says we're supposed to be getting. Nobody's coming out of school with anything remotely near that. But one of the most salient comments about the folks that got together and said, we've got to make a final stand here on the West Coast. There's no place else to run from crap and corruption. We've got to do it here, is they said. And I have to acknowledge that it was plagiarized from the Illinois Constitution, but they said all power is inherent in the people.
Mm-hmm.
And when they come together to form a social compact, they are equal in right. And they institute government for their own peace, safety, and happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And they retain at all times the right to alter, reform, or abolish government by any means that they may think proper. Now, the problem with us, and not knowing that, is that we look to external authority as though it may save us, instead of understanding that all power is inherent in people and men are equal in right. So there's no one to tell us, hand us over your money. Most of us don't know that the vast majority of taxes that we're paying in this country are not required by law to be paid by us, but have always been properly laid on corporations. The long-term planners have figured out how to convince us that we're all, quote, persons, and a person is a statutory term for one whom that is subject to. But most of us are human beings, citizens, members of the public, anybody else, but generally not statutory persons. And with that, unless I can answer a question or two from you in the time remaining, I'll seek feedback from other listeners.
Oh, thanks very much for the call. We're going to move on, but I do appreciate your comments. And I think you've touched on the notion that is very important, that the creation of the corporation as a fictitive person, a dreadful decision of the late 1800s, is in part responsible for some of the issues we have today, as well as the notion that power does ultimately and must ultimately rest in the people themselves. That's a good point.
Yeah, and he touched on something else very important in the same vein, is that we've a great many of us have been convinced that it's to the detriment of the rest of us if corporations are actually forced to pay what they should be paying.
You know, just very briefly, beginning today, I talked about, the National Endowments for Democracy and the International Republican Institute and other agencies that are semi-governmental, that get governmental money and have, for example, messed over Haiti, as in the New York Times on Sunday. We talked about all the demonstrations that are going to happen from 4 o'clock on to about 7 during the State of the Union. There's going to be, and pre-State of the Union, there's going to be chanting and gatherings and all kinds of stuff all over the city, but the main thing is to show up around. If you want to, show up around at Pioneer Square of 4 to 5 o'clock and get started there. I also think we talked a little bit about the sad death of Stu Albert. You talked about the obscene profits of Exxon Mobil.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it Mobil Exxon? I don't know. And I think this is all pretty important stuff. Let's go to... Do we have time? Yeah, we have...
Sure. Who do we have, Eduardo? Emma, good morning.
Yeah, I was just wanting to talk about what you were talking about earlier about humans being hardwired to not be altruistic, and I would actually disagree with that because most of human history has actually been an egalitarian matriarchy, and we would not have evolved without the ability to be altruistic and help each other survive. So I believe it's actually very hardwired in this patriarchy that we're living under is just a brief... It's just a brief part of human history. It doesn't represent most of human history. And I think capitalism and patriarchy are self-destructive. They're ultimately going to collapse, and that we can move on from there. And so I just don't believe that, you know, I believe that we are actually hardwired to be altruistic. So that keeps me optimistic. It keeps me, you know, wanting to fight against the powers that be. A book I could recommend, it's a really great book. It's by Evelyn Reed. She was a Marxist anthropologist, and she wrote this great little slim volume called Sexism and Science, and she goes into talking about the anthropological studies of the matriarchy. And it's a really great book. I really recommend it.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
I really appreciate the insight myself.
I think we're hardwired toward altruism to a certain degree.
Ah, you're yielding on this point.
I am. Well, I said this a few minutes ago as well.
Okay.
We're hardwired to be altruistic towards those who are in our own tribe because the survival of everyone in the tribe depends on the well-being of everyone in the mm-hmm. tribe. Therefore, you protect and in some cases even sacrifice yourself to protect others in your tribe. The problem is that we've gone, and our system, our systems of governance and economics that we've created go to great lengths to wall others off from our tribe. And even within constructs like the nation state, we identify with others, other Americans, other Oregonians, other Portlanders,
in fact,
being not a part of our tribe.
It's true. In fact, in tribal societies, in pre-industrial societies, there was a tendency to call oneself the people and everyone else mm-hmm. the other of some kind.
Right.
Some you know, kind of dissing process. And the question of matriarchy is a very interesting one to explore. I would point out the Iroquois people had a very interesting social structure in this gathering together of multiple nations on the North American continent. Women actually owned all the property and had major roles in decision-making.
Electing the alpha male also. which is very, very interesting.
Well, yes, and again, property being held by the women, and most of the actual work, of course, being done by women, which is not uncommon throughout human history. All right, you know, I think we're out of time.
We are.
I want to remind people to show up and make your statement around the Bush, the illegitimate Bush presidency and the absurd State of the Union address. And, you know, if we don't keep on keeping on, who will?
Agreed. And I want you all to go out there today and invite some people to join your tribe.
Make some noise.
Yep.
All right, that's it. Stick tuned to KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
The Joe Uris program was made possible in part by Cable Foundation members and a grant from Awakened Media, presenting The Real Dirt on Farmer John, a film about the true story of maverick Farmer John Peterson's hero's journey of life, love, death, and sweet potatoes. It opens Wednesday, February 1st at Cinema 21. Information at realdirt.net.
Вслушиваюсь в каждый шаг, чтобы услышать, как по ступеням легкой поступью спешит твоя.